Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a ragweed-ravaged Rick Wood, as always. Welcome you to My Prerogative. We've had a number of very controversial guests on our show before. Tonight, we're going to have someone who's been on several times and has elicited more email response than anyone else. Mr. Mark Weber is director of the Institute for Historical Research. They refer to themselves as revisionists. Others refer to them as Holocaust deniers. We welcome Mr. Mark Weber. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on again. You know, I'll quibble with a couple of things you said, though. It's the Institute for Historical Review, not research.
Thank you.
And the website is ihr.org, which is easy to get to. But I don't like to refer to myself as a Holocaust denier. I know that's often an accusation that's made, but it's really not accurate. And I think that anyone who checks out the website can see that our view about that subject is rather more subtle or nuanced than that.
Okay. Well, and I'm sure we'll get to that at some point in our interview, Mark. I've spoken with you a number of times, and that's why I had phrased it both ways. I gave your version and, quite honestly, what I would consider my version of it. So, in all fairness, we're just going to we're going to chat today and let everyone make their own decisions.
Right.
I almost am afraid to ask this, Mark, but what have you been up to lately?
Well, we've been doing a lot. We had a demonstration in February outside the Canadian consulate in downtown Los Angeles calling for freedom for Ernst Zundel, a German-Canadian who has been deported to Germany since then and held in prison on charges of, quote, denying the Holocaust. It's a case that's gotten a lot of international attention.
First of all, to flesh that out for us, if you will, Mark, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but he has been accused of denying the Holocaust, not of being a Nazi, but
right.
of denying. Okay, flesh that out
right.
for me a little bit, please.
Right. Well, in Germany, in Israel, in France, in Switzerland, and several other countries, it's a crime to dispute publicly the official view of what happened to Jews in Europe during World War II. It's called Holocaust denial, and there's laws against it, and people are punished with fines and imprisonment for disputing the official view of this one chapter of history. It's the only chapter of history that has this kind of criminal protection, you might say.
Why do you suppose that is, Mark?
What's that?
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, it's a reflection of the end of the Second World War, but in most of the countries, these laws have been implemented at the insistence of Israel and of large, powerful Jewish organizations such as the World Jewish Congress, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and so forth. Zundel is now being held in Germany on the basis that he denied the Holocaust in a website called the Zundel Site, which is actually headquartered or based here in the United States. One of the ominous implications of this situation is that even if you grant that Holocaust denial is wrong or should be a crime, the so-called crime was committed, if it was, here in the United States, where it's not legal, not illegal. That is, people are free in America to say what they wish about this and other chapters of history. And it's an ominous thing that he's being held for supposedly denying the Holocaust on an American-based website, which, in fact, he doesn't even run. It's run by his wife, Ingrid Rimland, who was with us at the demonstration in February and at a meeting we held the day before.
Now, this may be the only thing that you and I will ever agree on, but I think I agree with you that in America you have a right to say any damn fool thing that you want to say. We have to protect everyone's right, no matter how ridiculous it is, as long as it's not advocating violence against another human being. That is one of our constitutionally protected rights.
But unfortunately, those rights are not protected in some other countries. And what's really, I think, outrageous is that this form of censorship is applied only to one chapter of history and reflects the power that Jewish Zionist and Zionist organizations wield in America and in other countries.
Well, also, it reflects the horror of what took place. And what we're not going to do right now is get into a chapter and verse of what happened, what didn't happen.
Right.
We can save that for a bit later. Now, what was the upshot of the Zundel case? Is he still incarcerated?
There is no upshot yet. He's been charged, and he's in prison in Mannheim, Germany, and he's awaiting trial. And I don't know. We don't know yet when the trial is going to take place, and he's being held pending. He's not been granted bail in Germany on this charge. But we also had a meeting a week ago Sunday, April 17th, at which I spoke and David Irving spoke. David Irving, for those who don't know, is a internationally recognized historian, a specialist on Third Reich and World War II. He's the author of dozens of books, many of them best-selling books, and the most important of which probably is his very, very detailed book called Hitler's War. And he spent many, many years doing very extensive research in archives and with other original sources to put together this monumental work. He and I spoke at the meeting on Hitler's place in history. Now, granted, a very dicey, emotion-laden subject, but one that people seem perpetually interested in. The stream of motion pictures and articles and books and so forth about Hitler and the Third Reich shows no sign of diminishing. And in fact, there's a new movie entitled called Downfall, which is showing in movie theaters around the world right now, about the last weeks of Hitler in Berlin.
Okay, and before we get into that, obviously that's a subject that we need to delve into. But let's get some
ground rules set, I guess, and see where you're coming from. You personally are not a big fan of Israel. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I'm not so much concerned about Israel, although I think that its policies are pretty outrageous. What I'm concerned about is the double standard of our country, which makes Israel's policies possible. We apply to other countries a standard that we do not apply to Israel. And the fact that American support for Israel is so boundless and so extensive has gotten us into conflicts with many other countries. And today, around the world, just about everywhere, both American and Israeli policies are harshly condemned and criticized, and I think for understandable reasons.
Okay, let me ask you just three questions before we get to this talk that you had regarding Hitler's place in history, just to get a feel for the IHR's point of view. Does IHR espouse hatred of Jews?
Absolutely not. In fact, we try very hard to distance ourselves from any expressions of hatred of anyone on the basis of their background, their ancestry, and so forth. We have support, and we are proud to have support from people of every possible ethnic, religious, and racial background, including Jewish. And we've had
not a lot of money's pouring in from the Jewish community, though, is it?
No. Okay. I mean, of course, I'm making a distinction here between individuals, no matter what their background, and what could be called, you know, the organized Jewish committee and community. And then by that, I mean powerful organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the American Jewish Committee, the World Jewish Congress, and so forth.
Now, let me ask you, as far as your funding, from where does that come primarily, Mark?
Our funding overwhelmingly comes from donations. And we encourage, of course, people to donate to support our work. Our work is supported in much the same way that groups like the Simon Wiesenthal Center or the American Red Cross or so forth get their funding. That is from donations. We also get
from where do those donations come, Mark?
From individuals, mostly overwhelmingly in the United States, but also some outside the U.S.
Are there?
We also sell books and tapes, and we get some. We get income from that as well. But overwhelmingly, our support comes from donations.
Do you feel that the Holocaust, as it is normally portrayed, where 6 million Jews were gassed, shot, or in other ways killed by the Germans during World War II, is a fabrication?
No, I don't say it's a fabrication. Obviously, Many Jews were killed. Many Jews died. It's almost unseemly to quibble about numbers. But this figure of 6 million isn't one that we quibble about or talk about. It's one that we're told over and over and over, and as a kind of insistence on it in our society. What I'm really concerned about here primarily is not what specifically happened or didn't happen, but the way in which the Holocaust story is used politically and culturally in our society for political, cultural purposes and ends. Every American, virtually, has heard over and over, Hitler killed 6 million Jews. But Americans have, even educated Americans, have almost no idea how many people of any other group or any other nationality died during the Second World War or even in other conflicts. We hear over and over and over about the 6 million and the Holocaust, but the deaths of larger numbers of people under tyrannical and genocidal conditions, we hear very little about, or certainly far less than we do about what happened to Jews.
Well, now, you and I have known each other for, at this point, I guess, 3 or 4 years, right, Mark?
Right.
And the first conversation that we had, actually, your tacks have changed over the year. And tell me if I'm making fair statements or not. Our first conversation, we got into an argument over the 6 million figure. And you came about at the end of that conversation with a figure under 1 million who basically died of dysentery and disease. Is that still your point of view?
No, I don't think so. I mean, even when I testified in 1988 as an expert witness on the Final Solution, I acknowledged that hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed. I mean, large numbers of Jews. And I think the number of Jews who died or were killed in World War II is more than 1 million. You were the one at the beginning of the program said you didn't want to get into the specifics of that, but
right.
The 6 million figure is I think untenable. I think it's unjustifiable. But again, that's something for historians to debate and discuss and to investigate. What's wrong are laws, I think, that prevent any deviation from an official or semi-official view of history.
Okay, and I hear what you're saying, Mark, and actually I'll send you a copy of the first tape that we made. I think you'll find that it's somewhat close to what we discussed. The reason that I brought that up, and I appreciate you not getting enmeshed into the quibble over the exact number, but what I wanted to say is that it appears to me, in reading the IHR's website, that your approach has changed to a good deal. Now, first of all, you're still very much revisionist as far as the history of the Holocaust. That's all over your website. But what it sounds is if now you're taking what seems to be a perfectly reasonable point of view that even if what this guy says is abhorrent, he's got every right to say it. A lot of people would agree with that. Has there been a philosophical change over the years, or is it just is this a way to get the camel's nose in the tent, Mark?
Well, I guess it's a cynical but a fair question. No, what I find is that the number of people who are really interested in the details of what happened in Poland or Germany 60 years ago decreases is less and less with the passage of time. What's important, I think, especially 60 years now after the end of World War II, is what's the relevance of all of this for us today? And I think it's just a matter of fact and reality that the longer, the more any event or is recedes into the past, the more the interest or the less there is in the details of that. What's important, I think, is that in spite of the passage of time, the Holocaust plays a seemingly ever larger political and cultural role in our society. It's different and plays a different kind of role than any other kind of chapter of history. And that is reflected on our website. The website deals much more, especially on the homepage and so forth, with contemporary issues or issues as they relate to the present.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have as our guest Mr. Mark Weber, the Director of Institute for Historical Research, a revisionist website, and you can find them at IHR.org. We're getting ready to chat with Mark in regard to Hitler's place in history. Let me ask you to give us a little more detail about that talk that you had with Mr. Irving in that regard.
Well, the basic point I made is that it's very difficult, virtually impossible in our society, to have a kind of objective or balanced view about Hitler. Now, many people would say, well, that's understandable. He was a monster and so forth. But we're able to look at other people who are equally dictatorial or whatever in history with somewhat more detachment. Now, an example of that I gave, if you check virtually any standard American encyclopedia and you look up Hitler and you look up Stalin, you'll find something kind of surprising. Most historians acknowledged that Stalin's victims outnumber those of Hitler. But Stalin is referred to in American dictionaries almost invariably as a Soviet premier or Soviet political leader or communist leader. Hitler is invariably referred to as a Nazi dictator. Stalin's not called a dictator. Mao Zedong, the Chinese communist leader, is not described in American history books as a dictator. He's described as a communist political leader or a Chinese leader or something like that.
Mark, now, are you honestly saying that people are describing Stalin as something other than a murderous lunatic?
I'm saying that when you look at American dictionary, and I take anyone, American Heritage, Merriam-Webster, whatever you put, you'll see Hitler referred to as a dictator, but not Stalin and not Mao Zedong.
Okay.
Stalin was, by any measure, at least as much of a dictator as Hitler was. My point is that there's a lack of balance. You'll find also unchallenged and widespread many statements made about Hitler which are just factually not true. And in the talk that I gave many examples of how and just why that is.
Now, the whole idea of Hitler and Stalin being the same or Stalin being worse, how does that negate any of Hitler's responsibility for what took place during his administration?
This isn't a plea to let's be nice to Hitler Day. It's a plea for balance. It's a plea for objectivity. And in our society, it's very difficult to talk about Hitler in the same kind of objective way that we try to talk about other personalities in history and other chapters of history.
If we were talking objectively about Hitler, what would we be saying?
Well, one of the points that's one of the most common charges or claims that's made about Hitler, and I saw this the other day in the World Book Encyclopedia, is that Hitler tried to take over the world. Well, that's just grotesquely untrue. That's just manifestly not true. But to say that Hitler didn't want to take over the world makes a person sound like he's trying to defend Hitler. I'll give an example, and in fact I gave it at the talk. Some years ago, Patrick Buchanan wrote a column in which he was writing about a biography of Hitler that had just appeared, and he criticized Hitler, he condemned Hitler, but he mentioned in passing that Hitler was a courageous soldier during the First World War, that he was an effective public speaker, and that he was an outstanding political organizer. Now, just for making those statements, which are true, they're factually true statements, Buchanan at the time and for years, ever since, has been condemned for, quote, praising Hitler. Now, it's not praising Hitler to say that he was an effective orator or that he was a skilled political leader or that he was a courageous soldier during World War II. That's a fact. Those are factual statements. But it's so difficult to say something, even truthful statements about Hitler, as Pat Buchanan did, without being swiftly and immediately condemned for supposedly praising Hitler. Now, that's what I mean by this lack of objectivity, this lack of balance in our society.
Okay, I get you there, Mark. But what I'm asking is, if we were having an objective discussion of Adolf Hitler, what would we be saying other than he was courageous in World War One and he was a good orator?
Well, what we would do is not have so many untruthful statements about Hitler that you'll find in standard reference books.
Give me some
for instance. To say that Hitler was trying to take over the world. In fact, he went to extraordinary lengths to cultivate friendship with Britain. It was Britain that was in Germany, not the other way around. Hitler was trying very hard to avoid war with the United States at the time when Franklin Roosevelt, the American president, was not only doing everything in his power to get the United States into war against Germany, but was making absolutely grotesque lies about Hitler to make the American people believe that Hitler was trying to take over the United States, in fact. And I gave various examples of that. Look, one of the most obvious things is that the portrayal of Hitler for many people the image of Hitler is a guy who's kind of half crazy, who stands up and starts screaming and yelling about Jews, and then all these crazed Germans all start supporting him. I mean, that's sort of ludicrous even on its face.
Well,
no political leader is going to get support if he stands up and starts raving about Jews or anything else for that matter. And it's difficult to understand Hitler and understand why he had the importance he did in history without understanding what really happened. And unless we understand what really happened and how it happened, we can't come to grips with it.
Was Hitler a drug addict?
Well, apparently, I mean, I'm not as much an expert on this as David Irving, some others, but he apparently did, and he wasn't an addict, but he had injections during the last year or so of the war that were kind of like, I guess, stimulants. But I really refer to other people who know more about that particular subject than I do.
Well, I think the implication there is if you're having injections of stimulants, that probably is prima facie evidence of not being the most stable person on the planet.
I'm sure. That would seem to be.
Additionally, and I guess we're going to have to get into the whole Holocaust revision thing because everything inevitably and inexorably works towards there.
Okay.
Let me ask you some questions, true or false questions, I guess.
Okay.
Did Hitler oversee and order the systematic extermination of the European Jewish population?
Well, there's no evidence that he gave an order to systematically exterminate all the Jews of Europe. He did give orders that led to the killing of many Jews. I've said this and written this, but there seems to be, it's very hard to find any evidence of an order to destroy the Jews of Europe. I mean, one of the most obvious things is that many, many Jews survived the war and were not killed. I mean, and who would have been if such an order had existed?
Are you saying that there was no systematic killing of Jews in any of the concentration camps?
There was killing of Jews, but not systematically, not in the way that's portrayed. What's portrayed, we're told, is that every Jew who was rounded up was slated for extermination. I mean, probably the best-known Holocaust victim is Anne Frank. People have read the diary. The diary is very well-known. And her fate is fairly typical of that of many Jews in Europe during World War II. She was arrested or seized in August 1944 in Amsterdam, where she had been hiding. And she was sent to Auschwitz on a train. And as the Red Army was approaching Auschwitz, she and her sister were evacuated from the camp to a camp hundreds of miles to the west called Bergen-Belsen, and she died during the final months of the war. Not killed, not exterminated, not gassed, but she died of typhus. Now, I'm not saying it's pleasant or anything, but it's different than being a victim of extermination. Her father survived Auschwitz because he was in the camp infirmary, in fact, and he was in the camp hospital when the Red Army liberated or took Auschwitz in January of 1945.
How many people were gassed at Auschwitz?
That's very difficult to say. There's a great deal of discussion. And there's been a tremendous reduction over the years in the numbers of people who died or were killed at Auschwitz. At the Nuremberg trial in 1945, it was claimed that 4 million people were killed at Auschwitz. No historian today believes such figures. It's now said more or less, well, perhaps 1 million people died at Auschwitz of one cause or another, and there's still some discussion of that. And I mean, unquestionably, hundreds of thousands of people died or were killed at Auschwitz. I don't dispute that. No, I don't know anybody seriously who does. But it's a very different thing than a systematic extermination overall in Europe and especially in other camps. I mean, it was claimed and supposedly proven at Nuremberg that people were gassed at Dachau, at Buchenwald, and at other camps in Germany proper during World War II. No serious historian today anymore supports or affirms those claims.
That gassings didn't take place at those locations.
At those locations, that's true, even though they were supposedly proven at Nuremberg in 1945. The first claims made about Auschwitz when the Soviets took the camp were that people were killed systematically at Auschwitz, not by gassing, but in a very elaborate electrocution process. That was the claim that was first made to the world in 1945 by the Soviets who liberated the camp. And then later the story was changed from electrocution to gassing.
What is your personal opinion? Were people gassed in the concentration camps?
I don't like to talk about what may or may not have happened. I like to deal or talk about what specific claims are made at such and such a point.
Claims were made
for example,
that people...
For example, as I mentioned, claims about Dachau that were supposedly proven, and I visited Dachau. I was very surprised by what I found, by the way. But the claims made about Dachau have been abandoned. In the case of Auschwitz I, Auschwitz, the main camp, it was claimed for years that people were gassed there. David Irving, in some years ago in Munich, just simply said in a speech that the gas chamber shown to tourists for years at Auschwitz I, Auschwitz main camp, is a post-war phony reconstruction.
Because now, the first one was blown by the guards at Auschwitz
so that they could try to avoid war crimes. That one, frankly, Mark, is the most dishonest piece of flotsam that Holocaust deniers put across. Obviously, they were rebuilt because they were blown by the Nazis.
I'm talking about Auschwitz I, not about Birkenau or Auschwitz II.
Okay, forgive me.
I'm talking about Auschwitz I. And if you go there now, it's conceded by the camp administrator, or the museum that it was rebuilt after the war, that it was, in fact, a phony post-war reconstruction. But my point is that Irving making that statement at a speech, for having made that statement, he was fined, he was banned from the country, even though the statement was true. Now, it's very difficult to determine exactly what happened at Auschwitz and other places when there are laws that actually forbid stating publicly truthful statements about Auschwitz and other places when you have these kinds of laws in effect.
Let me ask you, Mark, why is it that we're striving so mightily to get the facts straight in World War II? It doesn't seem that there's a big impetus on your website to get the facts straight on the Crimean War.
There's no dispute about it, because it doesn't have the same political and social relevance in our society. There is an official U.S. government agency, the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, that was set up by the U.S. Congress to memorialize the Jewish victims of World War II. There's no comparable institution in the United States government for any other victims. These are non-Americans, victimized by non-Americans 60 years ago, but we have a U.S. government agency and an enormous museum in Washington, D.C., the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, set up to memorial. It's the reason we focus on this is because this particular chapter of history has such an important political and cultural and social relevance in our society. The Crimean War does not.
So when
we can argue and discuss about the Crimean War without any fear of being arrested or punished.
So when we cut through all of it, what it's really about, Mark, is the Jews, isn't it? That's what it's really about. Because what you feel are the overwhelming political and cultural influences of the Jewish community. That's really at the heart of it, is it not?
Well, it's unquestionable that the Holocaust story plays the role in our society that it does, because this is a major point of the agenda of Jewish organizations in our country. I don't think there's any dispute. Numerous Jewish leaders acknowledge this fact. Why? What other possible reason is there that we hear far more about the victims of Hitler or Jewish victims of Hitler than we hear about the victims of Stalin or Mao Zedong or anyone else in history?
So
what other possible explanation could there possibly be for this fact?
So that realistically, if you're able to undermine the story of the Holocaust, you're able to undermine Jews in general. Is that a fair statement?
I think that the Holocaust story plays the role it does in our society because it is an expression in our society of Jewish Zionist power. Now, it's not the source of that power. It's an expression of that power. But that power plays a role not only in how we look at history of World War II, but how we look at the history of the Middle East and how we look at many other issues as well. That's why virtually around the world, the history of the Middle East is looked at rather differently than it is here in the United States.
Okay,
and it's reflected that America's policy toward Israel is different than that of any other country in the world.
So
that's a reflection of the same power, which also has the role it does, plays the role it does, in how we perceive history as well. Not so, just history about World War II, not just history about the Holocaust, but the history of the Middle East as well.
Okay, so when we get through it, really, the whether it was 6 million Jews or 3 million Jews or 1.5 million Jews, that really doesn't matter.
What really matters is what you feel is the unproportionate amount of power that Jews hold over global affairs, right?
Right. Well,
so let's talk about what powers the Jews do hold in your opinion.
Good point. I mean, will you acknowledge that in fact we have a kind of unbalanced view of World War II and of the Holocaust that is in fact a reflection of Jewish Zionist power in our society?
No, absolutely not. I will
now,
not see, agree
why
to that.
Do you think?
The reason, now, first of all, if we want to talk on a historical point of view or my views of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they're two separate things. First of all, I think, in my opinion, Mark, you guys are being dishonest because you're pulling the same techniques that creationists use by taking a proven point and trying to quibble about one or two minute items and say, therefore, the whole thing is wrong. Now, that being said, and we disagree with that, and frankly, we only have another 20 minutes or so together, and you and I aren't going to convince each other of that. But do I feel that Israel has been unfair to Palestine and that they've killed Palestinians indiscriminately? Yes. But those are two separate things.
That wasn't my question, though, Rick. My question was, would you acknowledge that we hear far more about Jewish victims of World War II, that we hear so much about the Holocaust as an expression of Jewish Zionist power in our society? Why do we hear more about Hitler and Hitler's victims than we do about Stalin's in our society?
Because we have far more European immigrants than we did Chinese immigrants or Soviet immigrants. We hear the story. We heard our parents heard the stories far more personally than they did. Now, is the Jewish community going to use that to their advantage? Of course they would, just as
okay,
any of us
and
would.
Do they use it to their advantage?
Of course they do.
Okay, and how effectively do they use it to their advantage? I think very effectively, so much so that we have a special U.S. government agency. We have museums in every major city in America. We have a portrayal of history when it comes to World War II that is skewed. That's a reflection of power in our society.
Now, the portrayal is not skewed, Mark, and that's where you and I disagree, and actually we need to get off of that because
the
historical point has been proven. It has been proven. There have been hundreds of Nazis who confessed to crimes. Not one of them is recanted, and that is beyond dispute. And frankly, trying to go back and say, well, they weren't gas, they were this, it was Zyklon B, then it wasn't Zyklon B. You guys have changed your stories over the years.
Rick, you'll remember it wasn't me that brought up this. It was you in this conversation.
Okay, I understand that. But let's go back to what the IHR's central purpose is. It is basically to bring down, as you say, the Jewish Zionist power structure. Is it not?
No, I don't use terms like that. I mean,
you just said Jewish Zionist.
Look, I'm in favor. The IHR has dealt with other issues besides those involving Jews or Jewish interests too. We deal with many other subjects. We've dealt extensively with World War II in other ways, Japan and the bombing of Hiroshima in Japan Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example. The Spanish-American War doesn't, to my knowledge, have anything particularly to do with Jewish interests. But we deal with other subjects. But my point is, historical subjects which have this political role in our society that are of special interest to us because they play such a role politically and socially in our society.
In a perfect world, what would happen with the Jewish Zionist power structure as it exists now?
Well, I don't know about a perfect world, but I think that America that no one group should have a tremendous power when it works against the interests of other people in the society. Israeli interests and American interests not identical. They often diverge. They're often different. And if there's a part of the public in America that is committed to supporting Israeli interests, even when they're harmful to American interests, that's a dangerous thing for our country and for the world.
Do you think the vast majority of American people support Israeli interests over American interests?
Not knowingly. No, the vast majority of Americans have been convinced that American interests and Israeli interests are identical. But I think that that's not true. Let me put it another way.
Okay.
Around the world, there is a situation where virtually the whole rest of the world takes a different view of Israel and its policies than the United States. Why is that? Are Americans just more smart? Are they better? No. I mean, it's a reflection of the Jewish and Zionist power here in this country. What other explanation could there be?
Well, there are a couple of questions that I do have. In order for Israel to exist in the Middle East, and let me ask you to play the head of the new Palestinian state.
Okay.
What does Israel need to do in order to simply have a right to exist, or do they?
I don't know, but I don't know that America has a duty to guarantee Israel's existence any more than we have a right to guarantee the existence, say, of the old former Soviet Union or Yugoslavia or many other countries or nations or structures that have disappeared over the years.
So realistically, if Israel disappeared off the face of the map, that wouldn't be a great tragedy, in your opinion?
Well, it would be a tragedy. It would be a terrible tragedy for many people involved. That's a terrible thing. That would be an awful thing.
But
it would mean many individual tragedies.
But not as far as the socio-political aspect of it.
Well, what's happened is America. It's like, would it be a tragedy if America lost in Vietnam? Well, it is. It was a tragedy. There was many individual tragedies as a result of that. But it was a greater tragedy, I think, to have committed supporting what was an untenable struggle in the first place in Vietnam.
So say what you just meant there, Mark, that you think it is a tragedy that Israel is an untenable solution in the Middle East.
Well, the tragedy is, in 1948, when Zionists proclaimed the State of Israel, America's Secretary of State, George Marshall, the American Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, the head of the Near East branch of the State Department, all the top officials urged the United States not even to recognize the State of Israel, not even to recognize it, because it was an untenable state. They argued, with immense foresight, I would say, that for the United States to commit to Israel would tie us down for decades, for endlessly, into conflict in that part of the world, because the State of Israel is not tenable on its own. It requires for its existence huge infusions of aid and support from the taxpayer, military weapons, and so forth. That's an untenable, that's a dangerous situation.
Well,
especially when Israel carries out policies that are we would condemn and have condemned when carried out by any other country in the world.
Well, you know, when we annexed Texas, it ticked off the Mexicans too. But the point is, after a certain period of time, it seems that everyone just has to get used to the fact that so-and-so is in your backyard. And that doesn't seem to be the case in the Middle East. Let me ask you this.
That may be, but that's not our struggle. The struggle between Arabs and Jews in Palestine or Israel is not our struggle.
So Israel's
not a state of the United States.
We don't have any political interests in the Middle East.
What's the point? I mean, we do, but what's the point of your question?
Well, as far as a political interest in the Middle East, do we should we have, for lack of a better term, a satellite in the Middle East, so that
Israel is not a satellite of the United States. The United States is treated as a satellite of Israel. We follow Israel's lead. Repeatedly in 1967, in 1973, Israel has carried out wars against the wishes of the American government and forced us to back them.
Well, now, let me ask you. Let me ask you. Hasn't Israel been attacked as much as it has attacked in that part of the war? Did they start the 67 war, for instance, in your opinion?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
It's a matter of fact. And the United States agreed at the time to a Security Council resolution that now we're abandoning. The Israelis carried out the attack. They said that they were going to be attacked, so they struck first. In 1973, Israel attacked, October 1982, Israel attacked Lebanon, and the Israeli prime minister at the time lied not only to the public, but even to his own cabinet in carrying out this attack, which was unprovoked, which, I mean, it was carried out on the basis of a phony pretext, and Israel carried out the attack even in violation of American law.
How have they been able to maintain this monolithic structure of their own nation in Israel and power within the United States? Tell me how one develops a power structure that organized and that tight.
Well, a very key feature of this power is the influence in the media, of which the Holocaust story is an important part. Americans are expected to have a tremendous sympathy to Jews because of the Holocaust. People say over and over, well, Hitler killed those Jews, that's terrible, we've got to support Jews, we've got to support Israel. That's said over, and Americans are just simply expected to have more sympathy for the deaths of Israelis or Jews than they are for the deaths of non-Jews.
So if what we're able to do, if we're able to obfuscate what Hitler did by including Stalin's works and Mao Zedong's works, then what we basically do in the IRH view is to, in essence, dilute the sympathy of the Jews and therefore be able to...
That's not the point.
Sure it is, Mark. That's all you guys have pointed at, is because if you can dilute the Holocaust story and bring these other points in, then you dilute, and in your mind, rightfully so, but then you dilute their political influence and power, don't you?
Well, if to the extent to which Jewish power is based upon a distorted view of history, then correcting that view, having a more objective view of history, will inevitably lead to a that power. But look,
that would be yes.
No, I mean, well, I wouldn't put things that way. I wouldn't say things like that. Jewish Zionist power is a fact of life in America. It's an important fact of life. It helps explain. It's an important factor in our political life, our social life, our cultural life. It's an important factor in our foreign policy, and I think that identifying that power is of the greatest importance, a huge importance, because unless we understand that power and the interest and the agenda that Jewish and Zionist groups have, then we are just mystified and confused about what the reality in the world today is and where we're going from here.
What should the United States' role in the Middle East be? Let's forget about Israel for a moment. What should the United States... I got a different question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Do you feel that the invasion of Iraq was a direct result of Israeli influence?
I don't know if it's a direct result, but certainly the war was seen by the people who planned it and wanted it as a war in Israeli interests. Remember, the plan for this war was in place, and the people who carried out this plan, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, and so forth, wanted this war before Bush was president, before 9/11, and they've been calling for this for a long time. They don't want this to stop just with the war in Iraq. They want to subdue all the regimes in the Middle East that they regard as hostile to Israeli interests. And there are any number of people who are very much more knowledgeable about than I who have acknowledged that. In fact, the Israeli factor is a decisive or crucial one in the U.S. war in Iraq. Why do you think the United States went to war in Iraq?
I have not the slightest idea, because it's obviously and let me finish. Okay, first of all, I'm not agreeing with your point of view, but I'm not going to disavow it because it's the craziest damn thing I've ever seen. And there's obviously reasons other than weapons of mass destruction. Precisely what they are, I have no idea. But I can't disavow anything at this point.
Okay, well, look, I think you'll agree that understanding the real factors and motives behind this war is an important thing, because we're now involved in a very messy situation in that part of the world. And now we're talking, now we hear a lot of rhetoric similar to what we heard a couple of years ago about a new war against Iran. Sometimes we hear talk about war against Syria. And some people claim that the war is about oil. But that doesn't explain why the United States talks about going to war against Syria. Syria doesn't have any oil. But what these countries do have in common is that they are all adversaries of Israel.
Now, do you think, in your personal opinion, that it would eliminate a lot of the hostilities in the world if someone was able to snap a finger and Israel disappeared?
Well,
I'm not asking you for a value judgment. What I'm asking you for is...
Yes. I'll put it this way. The situation is now a tragedy because there are many Jews living in Israel. And if Israel were to disappear tomorrow, it would be a very tragic situation for the Jews that live there, obviously.
Nobody wants
a bloodbath. Nobody wants mass killing and mass death.
I'm not saying that. Asking you to put on your just supposing glasses for a moment, okay?
And if there were a way that we could magically snap our fingers without killing a whole bunch of people, and we could levitate Israel to the middle of Utah, probably next to the nuclear storage facility for your purposes, okay?
Would that improve the situation in the Middle East overnight?
I couldn't say. That's a speculative question. I don't know the answer to that. I just do know that Israel has been involved in conflict after conflict in the Middle East, that its existence requires constant infusions of military aid and money aid from the United States, that Israel and the United States are on the one side and the whole rest of the world sees the situation differently, and that if we continue to follow the path that we have been following, the result, I think, will be more wars and more conflicts, and the American people will pay an ever higher price for this so-called special relationship with Israel.
Okay, Mark, you've got about 2 minutes. I want you to give us your website one more time and give us about a minute and a half of the Mark Weber wisdom,
Rick,
if you will.
Rick, I want to thank you. You keep me on my toes. You are very good at challenging anything I say, and I appreciate that because it's important to be kept on my toes. I urge those people who are listening, if they want to know more about this, check out the IHR website, www.ihr.org. I think you'll see that the information we provide is substantive, is well argued, and absolutely necessary in America today.
Well, Mark, thanks for joining us. Unfortunately, we actually agreed on something today, so that means I'm just completely screwed up at this point. But I do appreciate you joining us, and we'll look forward to talking to you in the future. Okay.
Likewise, Rick. It's always stimulating and always a pleasure.
Take care, Mark.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, Mr. Mark Weber, Institute for Historic Research. I think it's important that we see that the whole idea of both creationists and Holocaust deniers and people who have a point to sell is they'll take a proven subject and try to create doubt about it. And then if they can dilute it enough, then they can poison our minds. Thanks for fighting a good fight, guys. Look forward to seeing you next Thursday night at midnight.